My name is Gordy Burris. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. It's a privilege to be here. This is it's a powerful, powerful weekend. I want to thank Chris and Chris for hosting me, and Harlan for throwing me under the bus. I want to thank the other speakers. You guys were absolutely fantastic and kind of pissed me off. I have a 3.5-hour drive home tomorrow. I plan on developing a really solid resentment about that. My sponsor's sitting over there. He heard that. I'm sure writing will be involved. I'd really like to tell you how I got to be who I was when I showed up in Al-Anon, what happened to me here, and what my life is like today. And my story starts, first time I got asked to speak, I went to my sponsor and I said, Jerry, they asked me to speak, what do I do? And he said, well, don't swear, don't drool, don't lean on the podium, give them what you got. That is my plan today. I do have a plan. It's one of the reasons I'm in Al-Anon. Have a plan for every one of you, too. That's what keeps me here. My story starts with my dad. I was telling Chris, I am second-generation American. My grandfather was an immigrant. And my dad grew up during the Depression, and they were really poor. They had nothing. So money was really, really important to him. So that meant that if, you know, whenever he had a chance to take a job where he could make more money, he would do that. And it meant we moved a lot. And moving is the beginning of my story. I went to 4 elementary schools, 1 junior high, and 3 high schools. And, you know, I grew up in a family with the ism of the disease. My dad drank every day of his life. I never saw him drunk, but we had all of the hallmarks of a family affected by alcoholism. What happened in our house stayed in our house. We didn't talk about anything. And I always knew my dad loved me, and there was no doubt in my mind that he loved me. And he did his. Now, we never went without. We had cars, we had food, and we had a really good home. But, you know, my dad had a problem with rage, and when he got mad, something physical was going to happen. And, you know, I remember the first time I ever saw stars when my dad hit me. I was in first grade, and I caught one of his backhands. And the last time we got into something physical, I was 16 years old, and I made the mistake of raising my hands to my dad, and I caught a left and a right and wound up on the ground. And, you know, it's, believe it or not, it's not that big a deal, because this is what I learned over time. My dad was raised in a really physical house. He got beat with all kinds of things, and he wanted to be a better dad. He made sure we had stuff. He never hit me with anything other than his hands, and in his world, that was being a better dad. And, you know, I came to really appreciate that. It took me a while to get there, but that's the truth of it. So when we were moving, I didn't like to move. We always seemed to move in the middle of the school year. And in third grade, when, you know, dinosaurs roamed the earth, remember pencils, they were this big and you used to write with them? We moved in the middle of the school year, and I went into the classroom, and, you know, by that time, all of the cliques had been formed. And if you're the new kid, all the eyes are on you, and I was really uncomfortable about that. And I went out on the playground, and in those days, you know, there were the playground was a pecking order, and the bullies found me and beat me up. And I went home that night, and my dad said, hey, what happened to you? And I said, well, you know, I went outside, and these guys beat me up. My dad got down on his knees, and he took my hands, he balled them up into fists. He says, this is your left, this is your right. Punches are thrown in combinations. The fight's not over till one of you doesn't get up. And he expected me to go out and handle my business from that point on. And I did. I went back out, and I found those guys, and we settled it right there. And, you know, that was the beginning of a really formative process for me. What I learned was, if you have a good offense, you don't need a good defense. You don't have to win the fight. If you give yourself a good enough accounting, the bullies are going to leave you alone because they're looking for easy targets. And the truth was, I was teaching people to stay away from me. And I learned to do that physically and emotionally, and that's going to show up a little bit later. So, you know, in my house, whatever my dad said, we did. He called himself a benevolent despot, and most of the time he was, but he's actually a tyrant at times because he was large and in charge. We did whatever he said. And there was never a group conscience in our house. It was like, we're going here and doing this. Okay, that's what we're going to do. You know, one of the things I learned, and Josh hit on it, and Jack did too, when you're raised in a house like that, you learn to have your radar is up and running all the time, right? I'm really good at sensing the emotional climate in the house, because if my old man was going to cook off, I was getting out of town. I was not going to be in the damage in the damage area. And you know, that's going to show up a little bit later for me in my story. So we're going through, I'm the youngest of four. By the time I got into high school, all my siblings were out. And we had moved from the East Coast, and we're living in California. And I was in my third high school at the time, and I was just sick of moving. And I was exhibiting what can only be called passive-aggressive behavior, because I was in classes, and I would be getting A's and F's. And I'd be in advanced placement classes and getting A's and F's in the simple subjects, and the counselors were calling my parents in and saying the kid's capable, we don't know what's going on. And, you know, I just wanted to be left alone. When I was in high school, I turned 16, and money is important in our family. We're going to talk about that. And in our family, if you make the money, you get to spend it any way you want. And that's control, and we're going to talk a lot about control today. So I finally was making my own money. I had my own car and having trouble in school. And my dad started putting a lot of pressure on me. And it was two things. He wanted me to get out of high school, and he wanted me to get done so I could move out. And I think he was ready to have me out of the house. So I graduated from high school, and I think they let me out just to get rid of me. And my grades weren't good enough to go to a four-year school, so I went to a junior college. And I started my own company. And I was running a business that cleaned apartments for real estate companies that own apartment complexes. It was a flat fee, and we were making pretty good money. I had crews working for me and developing business. And, you know, I started to understand how to make money and how to use it. I got my grades up. I went up to a four-year school and went up and majored in psychology and sociology. Yeah, okay. Stick around. And I'm working two jobs. I'm working as a dispatcher for the state police on a swing shift, and I'm working at a theme park. And because I'm paying my own way. My folks gave me some help in tuition and stuff, but I'm paying my own way. I met a young lady, and we were getting pretty serious. And I'm on the swing shift one night, and the private line rings right next to my station. I pick up the line, and it's my girlfriend. And she said, my father had me up against the fence with a gun, threatening to kill me. And I, you know, in my family, we take care of our own. We were the kind of family that, you know, the world can be on its own, just don't mess with us. And so I rolled a couple units over there, and I went there after work, and I asked her, what is going on here? And she said, my dad's an alcoholic, and he gets like this. And, you know, that bounced right off my head. I didn't care what an alcoholic was. All I knew is I had to keep this guy away from my girlfriend. And that man did die from the disease several years later. So now I'm going through school, and I'm getting ready to graduate. She and I are getting pretty serious as a couple, and I graduate, and I get my degree, and I start working in the field of counseling, and I had a problem because all these people coming in to see me were screwed up. And I was remarkably ill-equipped at the time to handle it, so I made the decision that all budding humanitarians did. I joined the Marine Corps. You drop bombs on them, they don't talk back. It's easy. And the truth of that was, my dad was a pilot in World War II. We had his medals up on the wall, and we had his blood chits up there. And my dad was my role model. My dad was my image of what a man was supposed to be. And I knew that that had a profound effect on him, and I wanted to experience that. And I went into the Marine Corps what they call an aviation contract. And that contract says, if you can pass all of the tests and you're physically qualified, you get the chance to fly airplanes. I get married, take my bride across the country, get into the Marine Corps, did pretty well, get down to flight school. You have to take three tests. You have to take algebra, physics, and aerodynamics. And I passed physics, I passed aerodynamics, and I flunked algebra. I got called into the commandant's office, and they said, Lieutenant, you can't fly if you don't pass algebra. So they sent me to what they call stupid study, and I sat in a room with guys who were way smarter than I was, and in 3 days I learned algebra. And that taught me something. If I really want something, if I really want to make something happen, I can do it if I really apply myself. And I learned that work ethic from my dad. My dad got up in the morning before I got up, and he worked all day, and he came home and, you know, after dinner, and he was working again. On the weekends, he worked in the house. If you wanted to see my dad, you worked with him. So I learned what a work ethic was, and I applied myself. So I passed these tests, and I get into flight school. And the Marine Corps is a meritocracy when you're in school. They rank you from the highest performer down to the lowest. In the Marine Corps, they fly a lot of helicopters. They don't fly a lot of jets. So that means if you want to fly jets, you've got to score pretty high. And I was highly motivated. I finished at the top of my class, and I got into flight school and got selected for jets. And I went into jet training and got into advanced jets in Meridian, Mississippi. My daughter was born there. Her name's Brianna. You're going to hear about her, too. So I'm in advanced flight. I did really well. I'm one of those guys, I can make machines do what I want them to do. And I finished at the top of my class, and they said, "You can fly anything you want, Lieutenant. What's it going to be?" And I chose an airplane that had one seat and one engine, and I did that intentionally. Because the Al-Anon people are laughing. I was the only person that could make that airplane do what I wanted it to do. I didn't have to talk to anybody. There wasn't a crew member. I was completely in control of that airplane, and I loved it. I took my wife and my daughter and went out into the fleet and threw myself into becoming a Marine Corps pilot. And I did really well at it. I advanced quickly through the ranks. I was a division lead, a section lead. I got to lead strikes. I got to plan strikes. I did some really amazing things with airplanes. And I came home one day and my first wife said, "Your services are no longer required." What? I'm a captain of Marines. I'm throwing these airplanes around now. I got people following me. It's what? And what I hadn't done was I hadn't paid attention to my relationship. See, because I emotionally and physically I keep people at a distance. And I hadn't taken care of that relationship. And you know, we had to go through a divorce, and during that divorce, the legal system in its good judgment would not give me custody of my daughter, sole custody, because I could be deployed at any moment as an active pilot. And I was really filled with rage about that. I wanted to be the better dad. I wanted to do it my dad. I wanted to be a better dad with him than him. I wanted to be involved in what was going on in my kid's life, and this was keeping me away from it. And I was a rageful guy. And I don't know if you're really familiar with rage, but real rage is cold. It's calculating, and it's destructive. I'm not worried about the people out in the street screaming and yelling. I'm worried about the guy sitting in the back of the room being quiet because he's doing what I was doing. I was planning. And I told myself, there's going to be a chance for me in my life when I get my daughter back. And when that shows up, I'm going to wage a campaign to do that. And waging a campaign is a specific term, and I use it specifically. In the Marine Corps, if you're in an amphibious battalion and the United States places that battalion off the coast of your country, we're not going to sneak up on you. You know we're here. We're going to come across the beach and punch you in the mouth. And you know, that's how I understood how to do things. If a little force didn't work, more is better. So, I'm a single pilot now. I like women. Thought I'd go find another one. And I started going to honky-tonks, because that's what we do as pilots. I like women. I like to dance. I like to hold them close when I do. And I'm out at this honky-tonk one night, and there's this cute, short, southern girl, got a great accent, long hair, good dancer. I cut her out of the herd. We start talking. Now, there's a question you wait for when you're a Marine fighter pilot, right? And that question is, what do you do for a living? So we're talking, and, you know, we're having some drinks, we're laughing, and I'm waiting because I know the question's coming. Finally, she says, "What do you do for a living?" I puff myself up. "I'm a Marine fighter pilot." She says, "At least you got a job." I've missed a lot of red flags, people. Painted them green, too, Georgia. That's what I was doing. So we started going out. You know, I had no idea, you know, I didn't consider the competition I was up against, but we started going out. And I start to talk to her. Her name is Connie. She couldn't be here with you today. I'm going to talk a little bit more about her, too. So we start going out, and I start talking about the contracts of life, because that's what I know how to talk about. I'm a pilot. I can be deployed. I have a daughter from a previous marriage. If I get the chance to get this child back, I'm going to do that. And Connie said, "I can do that." And we decide we're going to get married. And we have the Marine Corps wedding, blues, and sword arch, and a whole nine yards. And we got started about a year later. I had to make a choice in my career. And, you know, I was tired of being away and unavailable. So I decided that I was going to separate from the Marine Corps and go out and build the American dream. And I started interview with a bunch of companies. And I talked to a lot of companies. This one company says, you know, Gordy, we think you can do what we do, but the bad news is we're not going to pay you a salary. The good news is you can make as much money as you can. And they showed me guys who were making some pretty good money. And, you know, my training had taught me, if you can, I can. And the other things that I learned in the Marine Corps, when you're, you know, it's tools that you've heard of but have become a hallmark of my life is, you know, if I'm in a situation that I've never been in before, I adapt. If I don't have what I need, I improvise, and regardless of the situation, I overcome. And in the Marine Corps, overcoming is a full frontal assault. We already covered that part. So I separate from the Marine Corps. I joined this company. I moved up into Washington State. I worked that job for 32 years. So I'm up in Washington, I'm starting my career in this company, and my daughter came up for a three-week visit. And that 3 weeks turned into a 1 year. I had my child in my custody. My ex-wife was in another state. I had a tactical advantage. And I went down into Seattle, and I interviewed with a bunch of lawyers and trying to get a custody battle started. And this one guy says, you know, Gordy, I think I can get your daughter back. And I looked at him and I said, I don't care what it costs. I don't care what it takes. You get my daughter back. And I got into a custody battle of epic proportion. And I could tell you, I'm not proud of the guy who waged that campaign, but I'm profoundly grateful for the outcome because I got custody of my daughter. So now my daughter's living with me, and we've bought our first house, and we've got a golden retriever, and Connie says, you know, I'd like to have a child of my own. I said, baby, I'm a Marine. I know how that works. And in 1986, our son Travis was born, and you're going to hear about him. So now I've got a little boy, I got a little girl, golden retriever, got a job that's starting to burgeon. But, you know, things were starting to get hectic in our house. You know, Connie and I were arguing a lot. And, you know, I had originally thought that that was the emotional problem of trying to blend a family and put a step family together. And the reality is that's when alcoholism started to show up in our lives. So we're moving along, and Connie and I are starting to argue a lot. It's getting really tense in the house. It got to the point where we were starting to escalate, and things were getting loud in our house. And, you know, I didn't think of this until last night when Jack was talking. My kids used to bug out, right? They would get in their rooms, and I had a role in that. So Connie and I are arguing, and it's getting worse, and, you know, I'm starting to complain about her drinking and keep telling her. It got to the point where I was telling her, you know, I don't want you drinking in the house, so she'd go drink in the garage. She's pretty creative. But things were really bad, and it got to the point where I was trying to control the uncontrollable and didn't know it, and I was putting more and more pressure on her emotionally. And, you know, if you meet Connie, she's like this big, right? And she would stand up to me, and we would get into battles of incredible proportion. And, you know, I was not a guy you wanted to pick a fight with. I will take everything that you've told me and shown me, and I will hold it back in here, and I will sandbag it, and when this fight starts, I will bludgeon you with it. And, you know, I did that with her, and I'm not proud of it, but that's the way it was. So as we're moving along in here, Connie's been drinking, and, you know, the car's getting parked on the neighbor's lawn. You know, car's getting parked on our lawn. Car's coming home without hubcaps, because if you hit curbs, the hubcaps start coming off. And, you know, I was believing that everything on the outside looked right. I was a cub master of a pack. I was a t-ball coach, a football coach, a baseball coach. Everything on the outside of our lives looked right, and on the inside, our family was dying. And things were starting to escalate again, and Connie was having trouble at work, and it's the progression of the disease. And as we moved along in this, it became apparent that alcohol was an issue in our house, and we'd been talking about the solution, and I was trying to give it to her. She wouldn't listen. One day she comes home and she says, I'm going to go to AA. Problem? Solution. So she would go to these AA meetings and come home and be hammered. And I gave serious thought about going down there and telling you guys how to do your job. I had never been to an AA meeting, but I was pretty sure I understood the premise. All right, she's not supposed to drink when this is going on. Now, my family had moved up to be near us in 1995. My mom and dad moved up. My brother moved out up into Seattle with us. He's a physician. And we're a non-talking family, but in November of 1996, my mom called me up, my non-talking mom, and says, you know, Gordy, they've got this thing called Al-Anon. It's for friends and families of alcoholics. Maybe you should go. And in my ever so gentle way, I said, Mom, I don't need to go nowhere. She needs to quit drinking. If she'll quit drinking, my life will be perfect. My wife has 19 years of sobriety. My life's not perfect. Be careful what you take from me today. The defining event for me in alcoholism took place in February of 1997. As I mentioned, my brother's a physician, and he called me up one day. I was out in the field, had one of those Motorola flip phones. You remember those? They look like a Star Trek communicator. You talk on them for 5 minutes, you heat your hands up, you know. I was somebody, I had one of those. And I get a call from him, and he says, Gordy, we got Connie down here in the ER. She's been drinking. You better get down here. We don't know if she's going to live. You know, I've been to a lot of these conferences, been to a lot of meetings, and I've heard about blackouts. But, you know, I had an emotional blackout because I was 50 miles away from that hospital, and I don't remember driving there. The next thing I remember is walking into that ER, and they're trying to get me to sign papers. You know, and I walk into the room where my wife is. They've got two large bore IVs in her, and they've got people running around, and they're trying to hook her up to different machines, and my world stopped. I don't know if you've ever had the experience, but I could not move. People were moving around me. They were doing things for my wife that I hadn't done for a long time. They were trying to take care of her, and they were trying to save her life, and they were treating her gently. And I hadn't done that because at that point in my life, I considered her inability to stop drinking a defect of character. If you don't drink, you don't get drunk. Explain the problem to me. And they're trying to put these papers in my hand to get me to sign them because they're going to have to intubate her because if you drink enough alcohol, you stop breathing and you die. And I promise you, that day alcoholism became real to me. I have never seen a body that still lived. I had to call my mom and dad and say, you need to pick up the kids from school. I'm down here with Connie. I don't know if she's going to live. They got my wife stabilized, got her up in a room, and I had to go home that night and sit with my parents and tell them that their daughter-in-law and tell my kids that their mother had almost drunk herself to death. And alcoholism was very real for me that day. So the next day, I went back to the hospital, and I had a plan. I went up into her room, and I ever so gently sat on the bed with her, and I said, here's the deal. You can go to treatment, or I'm going to put you on an airplane anywhere you want to go. I'm going to put a bunch of money in your hand. I don't ever want to see you again. And she said, I'll go to treatment. I drove her up to treatment, dropped her off. And my overwhelming recollection of the drive home was how quiet it was. For the first time in years, I knew that my wife wasn't going to be out drinking and driving. She wasn't going to be driving my kids around. I knew that she was in a place where she was going to be getting help and sitting with people who would be able to talk to her about her problem. And it was so quiet in my car. And when I tell people that in newcomers meeting, I tell them that, you know, living with alcoholism is like living with a hurricane. But the winds don't come up all at once. They don't just roll in. It builds up over time. And if you're trained the way I am, if you're in a situation you've never been in before, you adapt. If you don't have what you need, you improvise. And regardless, you always overcome. And I promise you, I've never overcome alcoholism. And I got home that night. The kids were up in bed. My parents left. And I walked upstairs. I went into my kitchen. I was going to make some soup. And we had golden retrievers at the time. We're dog people. We love them. Our dogs are people to us. We talk to them. You know, they live in the house with us. My office is in the house. They have beds in there. At one point, we had two golden retrievers. And you know, I own the house. I live there. I have one bed. We had two dogs. They had eight beds. Four of those were orthopedic. So I walk up into the kitchen. I start making soup, and my golden retriever sits down right next to me, raises her eyebrows, and says, you're nuts. And that was a moment of clarity for me. And I'll tell you what happened. When my dog sat there and looked at me, I realized that everything I had built my life on was sand. Everything I was showing the world was not the reality. It looked right on the outside, but on the inside, my family was dying. If you haven't figured it out by now, I'm an analytical. Things come into my life, they become boxes. I put them in my head, and I deal with one box at a time. And all the boxes that night fell out of the floor. It fell out of my head and onto the floor. And there was one box there that said relationship with Connie that I hadn't touched in a long time because I did not know what to do with it. Everything I had tried to do to help my wife only helped her stay in her disease, and she was now in treatment. So I keep pressing on. I go to the family treatment program, and I walk in, and I'm the classic Al-Anon. All the families there, yeah, my name's Gordy, what can I do to help? And they said, you need to go to Al-Anon. I said, really, what can I do to help? And they said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And they handed me a schedule, and on Tuesday, March 11th, 1997, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I pulled up to this Al-Anon meeting, and it's a church, that's a problem for me. And I open up the door, and I start walking down the hall, and people are laughing. There is nothing funny going on in my life. You people need to focus. And I walk in, and I walk into the room, and these people are hugging each other. You try to hug me, man, I will knock you out. Went in, and I sat down and said, yeah, my name's Gordy. I'm here from the treatment center. It's like, ooh, we'll do a first-step meeting. And they go around the room, and people are telling their stories, and it comes to me, and here's my story. My name's Gordy. My wife's in the treatment center. She's going to get out. Everything's going to be perfect. Life's going to go on. It is funny. And they get around to this one guy, and this one guy says, you know, Gordy, just because your wife's in treatment doesn't mean she's going to get sober. I look at this guy thinking, you and I are going to have a problem. You do not know the plan. So I go back to the treatment center, family night, yep, been to an Al-Anon meeting, and this counselor pulled me aside, and she says, listen, you need to get a sponsor. And I said, what is that? She says, you're going to guys work with guys, girls work with girls. She says, this is a guy you're going to talk to between the meetings. You're going to do the step work with him. It's where the heavy lifting is done. Don't come back without one. So I go back to that meeting. And next Tuesday night, I walk in, and there's one guy. It's him. You know, I know how to take direction. I know how to give direction. So I know what I had to do is after the meeting, I walk up to this guy. I said, listen, they tell me I need a sponsor. Will you sponsor me? The guy says, yeah, I'll sponsor you. And he hands me his card. This guy's an Alaska Airlines pilot. Ooh, spiritual people. Let me introduce you to the Gordy who was there. I look at this guy's card, and I look at him, and I'm thinking, listen, man, there's only two kinds of airplanes, fighters and targets. You're not flying a fighter. This is going to be easy. All right, so it's rigorous honesty. The guy was also an F-4 pilot in the Air Force, but we're not opening up that can of worms. God. And the reality was, I couldn't have told you that then, but I'll tell you now, is my higher power put that guy in my life because you know what? I needed a guy who understood how I thought. I needed a guy who talked my language and understood my background. And he says, listen, this is the way I sponsor. I want you to call me every day. I want you to buy Al-Anon literature. I want you to read it every day. I want you to go to 3 meetings a week, and you need to pray. I'm thinking 3 out of 4 is not bad. I'm not praying. $7.50 ought to be enough for this chicken outfit. This ought to be a piece of cake. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. So I go back and finish a treatment program. And Connie gets out of treatment, and 3 days later, she relapses. I don't know if you've fallen off a pink cloud, but it's a long way to the ground. I did something I'd never done before. I leaned into the program, and I leaned into my sponsor. And, you know, I've been at sponsorship conferences before and talked about the way I sponsor, and I had this lady get up in my face right after I spoke, and she says, you're a Nazi sponsor. I'm okay with that. And I'll tell you why. If Jerry had handed me his card and said, call me when you feel like it, I'd have never called that guy. I was not ready to tell anybody who I thought or if I had a problem, but I knew how to take direction. I knew how to follow direction. Or give direction. And you know, to this day, I sponsor that way with other guys. It doesn't work for everybody. You need to find sponsorship that works for you, but that's what I needed, and I got it. So in my sponsorship line, we have what we call knee to knees. We sit down knee to knee once a week, and we talk about things. And my first knee to knee with my sponsor, he sat down and said, you know, Gordy, here's your mantra. You will be kind, you will be considerate, and you will be tolerant. And I promise you that had never been on my resume. And, you know, he started to hold me accountable that. He said, you will be kind, considerate, and tolerant to your wife, to your kids, to the people you work with. That is your new mantra. And I'm going back to him. We sit down the next week, and I'm whining about what's going on because, you know, I don't understand attachment yet. I don't understand what Al-Anon is. I'm just whining about her. And he says, you know, Gordy, you need to give your wife the dignity to be who she's going to be. And here's my problem at that time. I did not like who she was. I did not like the active disease of alcoholism in my life. I didn't like something I couldn't control. I didn't like the impact it was having, and I had not learned to separate the disease of alcoholism from the woman that I loved. But I was taking direction. We get down to next week, and I'm whining about this, I'm whining about that, and he says, you know, Gordy, Connie's got a higher power, and you're not it. What? I was pretty sure my hat said God. And I'll tell you, because when I got to Al-Anon, my street went from horizon to horizon. And if you were on it and weren't doing what I thought you needed to be doing, we were going to have a conversation about it. So now we're moving along in the program. And in our area, we have some pretty big meetings. And my primary meetings at the time would break up. We had a step or a tradition meeting and a topic meeting. And I used to go to those topic meetings because I needed to emotionally puke on the people in there. I was crazier than a $3 bill. So I'm out there and I'm going to these meetings, and you know, I've been around for a couple months, and I looked over and I noticed that the crazy people are the ones in the topic meetings, and the ones that are laughing and hugging are in the step meetings. And I asked my sponsor about it. He says, and now you're ready. And that's when we started to do the step work. Now, my first sponsor came out of Idaho and Montana a long time ago, and there were no just Al-Anon guys in meetings, and they were dual members, and he was sponsored out of the big book. So the first time I went through the steps was through the big book. I have had three sponsors, as I've told you before. My third one's here. I did not kill the first two. They moved out of state. I had nothing to do with it. So we start down, and, you know, we do the reading, and writing's involved, and we're getting ready to write. And I said, you know, I got the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol, but it's my wife that's unmanageable, and he would not let me write that. I had to write the step the way it was written. I had a problem with the traditions, too. I don't know if I'll get to that. But so I started to do it, wrote the first step, and we sat and did that one. And, you know, Connie had been in and out, and she was always going to meetings, but she was struggling with relapse for a while. And I got into my second step, and we did that one, did the writing. And, you know, by this time I've been in the program several months. Connie's starting to find her feet in the program. And we get to the third step, and I wrote everything out. And I went to his house to do the third step. And he says, okay, we finished the reading. He says, now we're going to get on our knees and do the third step prayer. And I said, no, we're not. And he said, no, really, we are. And I got to tell you, I was incredibly uncomfortable with that. But my first sponsor was the first man I ever had a relationship with that wasn't combative. My sponsor never punished me. He only gave me guidance and correction. And, you know, I had learned what intimacy was beginning to look like. And I trusted him enough to go through the motions. And we did that. So then he hands me the sheets. He says, you know, we're going to do your fourth step. You know, and I'm classic Al-Anon. You know, you give me something to do, I'm going to do it. So I went back and filled out the four-step stuff. But, you know, I started putting him off when he was talking to me about it because I was not prepared to tell him who I thought I was. And he said, are you done? No, I'm not done. And I've been done for a while. And he called me up one day and said, what are you doing this weekend? I said, I'm not doing nothing. He says, good. He says, our sponsorship line's having a retreat in Montana. Pack your bag, bring your four-step. We fly out to Montana, this big Suburban pulls up, there's a bunch of guys laughing and joking, I get in the back, I'm the new guy, do not touch me, man, I will rip your arm off. We get out to the conference center in the Beartooth Mountains, and we get there at sunset, and their tradition is at sunset, they circle up, everybody holds hands, and says a seven-step prayer. And I get out of this car, there's couple hundred guys holding hands and praying. I'm thinking, I am in a cult. How do I get out of here? And the first meeting we go to is a fifth step call-up meeting. I get called up. No, I haven't done the fifth step, and my sponsor's sitting in the front row. And, you know, I found out later that these guys had a plan. What they do is they round up their sponsees with their four-step. They drag them 150 miles out into the mountains where they can't get away to do their fifth. And, you know, I did my first fifth step that night under the stars in Montana. And it was a powerful experience for me. Is it the best work I've ever done? No, it wasn't. But, you know, I sat there for the first time in my life and told a guy how I thought I saw myself. And, you know, when he talked to me after I finished, he says, you know, Gordy, you've always thought that you needed to be who everybody else wanted you to be. You thought you needed to be the best son. You need to be the toughest fighter pilot. You need to be the best dad. He says, who do you really want to be? Nobody had ever asked me that. I'd always been told what I needed to be. And you know what? It changed my life. And that has led to a program that I continue today. Over time, I have examined every value that was given to me and gotten to make a decision about whether it was really what I wanted, what it was, or if it was not. And I was talking to some people last night and today. You know, I've done a lot of things that were actions that weren't about who I was. It's who I, what I thought I needed to do. And I don't do that anymore. So now we're into, we finish that, we come back. Connie's found her feet in the program. Things are taking off, right? She's got an AA program going, and I've got an Al-Anon program going. My kids actually went to Alateen for a while, which is very cool. It's one of the story about my son. So my son was 10 years old, and he had found an Alateen sponsor that would take him in. And, you know, we're a pretty intense sports family. And we were watching a Mariners game back in the 90s, and, you know, they've been terrible forever. They're still terrible. But they actually had a lead in the game, and Lou Piniella was a manager, and he was bringing in a reliever that was famous for blowing games. And I told Travis, you need to go to bed now. So my son's going up to bed, and my house is 25 miles away from Seattle. The Mariners were playing in a concrete dome. And I thought I needed to yell loud enough at the TV so that the manager could hear me. And I'm screaming at the TV, and my son sticks his head out of the door and says, didn't cause it, can't control it. Recovery's a dual-edged sword. You know, we're moving along, and things are going pretty well. Connie's really got her feet. She's got a solid program. I've got a solid program. I'm going to fast forward a little bit here. By now, we're about 5 years into the program. And, you know, I'd been around long enough and I'd seen enough that there was not enough in my marriage to Connie to make me want to stay. And I told her, this is not going to work for me. And we had a solid Al-Anon program and we had a solid AA program, but we had no cross tracks. And I was talking to a sponsee one night on the phone, and this guy's using some incredible language about relationships. And I said, where are you getting this? I know this isn't your stuff. And he says, I've got a counselor that's got 28 years in both programs. And I said, I need that number. And I'm telling you that for two reasons. The first reason is this is just my story. The other reason is, if you're a sponsee and you think you're bothering your sponsor when you call, you're wrong. I talk to my guys every day, and every one of my guys is talking to me about something I need to be working on, and I'm profoundly grateful for that. So anyway, I get this counselor's number. Connie and I go see her, and I want you to think of the toughest book-thumping Nazi sponsor on steroids you've ever run into. She knew both programs, and she knew Bull when she saw it, and she was fearless about throwing the flag on us. And we got into a long-term situation. I'll tell you, we rebuilt our relationship from the ground up, and we needed to do that. And without getting into a lot of it, I stalled there. When we're working with this lady, she started to do single and couples interviews. And in one of my single interviews, it turned out that I had never done a direct ninth with my kids, the tough Marine pilot, right? And the reality was is I didn't have the ability to become vulnerable with my kids and admit my faults. I'd done plenty of living amends, and I'll tell you in a minute why I know that worked. But I've been doing living amends, and she says, you need to go sit down and do a direct ninth with your kids. And when I did, I sat down with them, and I got to tell you, my kids are some of the bravest people I've ever seen, because if you've been listening to who I have been, I wasn't good with taking criticism. And I sat down and I did this direct knife with my kids, and this is what they told me. Dad, we know you love us. There's no doubt that you love us. We don't go without anything. But if we're not good athletes, if we're not straight A students, there's conditional love that we don't get. And when you get mad, you're dangerous. That changed my life. I couldn't breathe, literally. I couldn't work, which is really unusual for me. The kids went to Connie and said, hey, what's with Dad? And they said, you leave him alone. He'll figure this out. And I went back to this therapist, and she said, Gordy, your problem's really very simple. You don't know how to love people. You insist on loving people the way you think they need to be loved. If you'll pay attention, the people in your life will teach you how they need to be loved. And the other thing she told me, and I carry this everywhere I go, love is never a feeling, it's always an action. If the people in your life don't know that you love them by the way you treat them every day, then you're not loving them the way they need to be loved. And that has changed my life forever. So I went back and was, by this time, the marriage is coming back together and the family's coming back together. A lot of good things are going on. But, you know, I took a hard look at my program, and there was a weakness in my program, and the weakness was the 11th step. I had been using the groups, and I've been using Al-Anon, and sponsorship is my higher power. And I knew I needed to change that. And I did what I know how to do in the program. If you're in the program and you have what I want, I'm going to ask you how you did it, and you're going to tell me how you do it. And I went to people who had great spiritual programs, and I asked them how they did it. And to a person, they told me, we find time to read, we find time to meditate, and we find time to pray. And, you know, I started to build a practice about that, and there's some people in the room who've been with me for a long time, and they're sick of hearing about it. But, you know, I have a daily practice that shows up for me. I was reading some outside literature, and there's a guy talking about claiming the first hour of his day for himself. Because if he doesn't take care of himself, the world's going to come crashing in, and he's not going to have a good day. And so what I did was I claimed the first hour of my day for myself. Nobody gets it. Nobody. And what I do is I read Al-Anon literature, I read non-Al-Anon literature, I journal, I meditate, and I pray. And I promise you I did that this morning in my room. I'll do it every day no matter where I am. And there's a really simple reason that I do that. Every day that I do that, my wife gets a better husband, my kids get a better dad, my sponsees get a better sponsee, and the world gets a better Gordy. And I feel better about the way I walk through the world. So what I want to do now is talk a little bit about the gifts of the program and talk some about my family and the way things are working now. You know, when my daughter was growing up, she lived in an alcoholic environment with an overbearing dad. And she had developed an eating disorder, and none of us saw it. We didn't understand what it was. But, you know, we knew how to find help by the time we found out about this. And we got her counseling, we got her help, and part of the direction was that she needed to leave the house and she needed to live on her own. And it was not a graceful exit for any of us. She left the house and things went dark for quite a while. And when my son was growing up, before we got into recovery, he was a really withdrawn young man because he wasn't safe. You know, he was 10 years old when we got into recovery, and he's doing a really brilliant job. And I'm going to start telling you how I know Al-Anon works. I got, instead of a card for Father's Day, I got a letter from my son. And he said, you know, Dad, the short part of it is he says, when I was young, there was a lot of you I liked and a lot I didn't like. He says, but you and Mom have learned to find help, and I want to be like you. And I can't tell you how much that means to me. My daughter moved out, and I said it went dark, and she met a young man, and he's a really good guy. And then she decides she's going to marry this guy, and it's the wrong guy. You know, a Nobel Peace Prize winning brain surgeon is what's right for my daughter. And she married this guy, and at that wedding, and my sponsor's here, he'll attest to this, my ex and her family was there, and none of them are in recovery. Most of them are affected by the disease, and we had a really good wedding. Everybody got along, everything went really well for us. And, you know, the truth is Josh is our son-in-law, and he's a good man, and he takes care of my daughter, and he loves her. And I got to tell you, my daughter is a younger version of me, and his hands are full. And one of the things that I learned when I'm in Al-Anon is, you know, I don't have the relationship with you that I want. I have the relationship that you want. And so what I'd do is I'd let my daughter know if I wanted to see her, and I'd just stay back. And things were moving along there. My son met a young lady, and they started going out, and they became a couple. And then they got married. And, you know, my daughter-in-law had never experienced the chaos of our family. She's only seen us in recovery. And they were getting ready to get married, and we were going up. And, you know, there's always a question when you get married. Is it going to be Mom and Dad? Is it going to be Gordy and Connie? What's the name going to be? And I stepped into the kitchen one day with her, and I said, "Sweetie, I just want you to know that we're not attached to this. You can call us whatever you want. You can call us Mom or Dad. You can call us Gordy and Connie. It's all good." And she got really quiet, and she teared up. And she says, "You know, I've been waiting to talk to you. I'd like to call you Mom and Dad." This is a young lady that comes from a really healthy family. And if you've been listening to who I've been, for me to become worthy to have another man's daughter call me dad is one of the most profound gifts I've ever been given. My daughter got pregnant, and it was still really dark. We got to see her a couple times. And, you know, we would really like to be involved, but we were giving her her room. And our grandson was born, and his name is Dylan. And we got to see him a couple times. But, you know, I got a call from her earlier this year, and she says, "You know, Dad, Dylan's really wearing me out. I need to take a nap. Can I come over, and will you take care of him while I sleep?" And my daughter used to come over 3 days a week, and I would hold my grandson while my daughter slept, and I got to be for her the father then that I was never before I got to Al-Anon. And it's a profound experience for me. We see Dylan twice a week. I babysit him, and, you know, it's the coolest experience I've ever had. I've got 100 or 200 pictures if you want to see them. And, you know, that child will never know an alcoholic grandmother. That child will never know the chaos of a family that's been in the turmoil of alcoholism and Al-Anonism, and we are profoundly grateful for that. My wife's a big part of my story. I wish she was here. I love having her here. It makes it easier for me. Connie and I are very involved in the program. I'm the AIS vice chair in Seattle. I sponsor my guys. I spend a lot of time with them. And, you know, that takes time away from my relationship. And one of the things that I learned is if things are important to me, I need to dedicate time to them. And so what I do is Thursday night is date night. I pay attention to my wife. At 5 o'clock, the phone goes off. All of my sponsees know it. If you've got the gun in your mouth, try not to pull the trigger until I talk to you in the morning. I'm not talking to you on Thursday night. I make a great big bowl of popcorn because I make really good popcorn. We sit down on the couch, and I hand her the remote. We watch some goofy TV, people. You know, when I got to Al-Anon, I talked about this before. I worked in business. I was really good at it. And part of my business involved contracts and bids. And bids are important. If you don't win the bid, you don't get, you know, you don't get the contract. You don't get paid. And in my office, they used to call me the pit bull. Hard to believe, but true. And I had a contracting manager on the phone one day, and we had a really big bid coming in. And one of our best contractors was late with the bid, and I was walking by her office. And she's on the phone, and she says, "Listen, you blank, 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 if you don't have your bid here by 5 o'clock, I'm going to let Gordy out of his cage." You know, it's funny, but it's not. One of the greatest rewards I've ever had in Al-Anon, there's a group of people sitting over here that know me from my meetings. And when I tell these stories, they have never met that Gordy. And I can't tell you how much it means to me to be able to say that. How am I doing on time here? One more story. Okay, so here's the deal. I'm heavily involved in different traditions and meditation and stuff. And I've always wanted to take Tai Chi. So I start taking a Tai Chi class, and I love it. I'm really good at it. It's a lot of fun. But it's momentumless motion, and it's focused meditation. But it's also based on martial arts. And I have taken a lot of martial arts when I was in the service. And the reason I'm telling you this is that, you know, if I have this committee in my head. I don't know if you have one. But I'm in the middle of this class with like 20 people, and we're going through this martial arts, this Tai Chi training, and it's all, right, it's spiritual, it's meditation. And since it's based on martial arts, you get into different positions, and I'll get to a certain point, and the committee comes up and says, this is a really good move. If you follow through like this, you come down, you can hit him in the throat. And the other starts saying, it's spiritual, it's meditation. No, but if you do this, this is what's going to happen. And the next thing I know, the class is like three moves ahead of me. I still struggle with the foundation that I was given as a child. I work hard on it every day. And, you know, I'm really proud that I get the chance to do that. And the reality is that, and I think Josh talked about it, maybe Jack, you know, I have been given a lot of lessons about different types of being a man. And I've learned that it makes me available to guys to work with them at a different level. The last one I'll tell you a story is that, you know, in Al-Anon, it's really common to have people who are conflict averse. Right? We'll be talking about conflict. And, oh, I don't like to do that. I don't want to make anybody upset. And I'm sitting there thinking, really? That's my best thing. When you're raised the way I was, when you get into conflict, the world snaps into focus for me. And I understand it, and I'm really good at it. And the reality is what I've learned is that was a defense mechanism that kept people away from me. And I don't do that anymore. And what I've learned to do is I've learned to take the armor off. I've learned to become vulnerable. When I was very small, I learned if I became vulnerable, you became abusive. And what I've learned is with the right people, I can take my armor off, I can become vulnerable and tell you the truth about what's going on. And what that does is it builds intimacy and it builds relationships that are far greater than any fear I've ever had. When I was on my spiritual path and seeking, I did what I do. I'm a researcher. I'm an analytical. And in the three daily readers of the Al-Anon books, at the bottom of every one of the pages, there's usually a reading from some spiritual entity. And there are readings from every faith and every belief on those pages. And what that did was it taught me if there's room for you, there's room for me. But there was one that changed my life, and I'm going to give it to you now. It's on page 30 of Courage to Change, and it's on page 169 of One Day at a Time in Al-Anon. And it's by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and this is what it says. There's guidance for each of us, and by lowly listening you shall hear the right word. Certainly there's a right for you that needs no choice on your part. Place yourself in the middle of the stream of power and wisdom which flows into your life, and then without effort you're impelled to truth and perfect contentment. I have never felt the truth and perfect contentment part of it, but I can tell you it's far richer than it's ever been. And you know, Al-Anon used to be the headwaters for me, and it still is the headwaters for me. I keep coming back to Al-Anon because that's where my spiritual program was built. But that spiritual river has taken me to places like this, and I listen to you guys pour your hearts out and tell your stories, and then we talk about who we used to be and to where we are today. And it's a profound and moving experience. But I told you about my Tai Chi story, right? Well, I don't always stay in the river. Sometimes I hit the bank. Sometimes I get out of the river. And when that happens, I do the thing my first sponsor told me. He says, Gordy, if your life's not going well, you call your sponsor, you read your literature, you go to meetings and pray. If that doesn't work, you call your sponsor, you read your literature, you go to meetings and pray. My wish for you today is that you find your own river of power and wisdom in your life. And if you hit the bank, you find a way to get out. It's been a privilege to be here. Thanks.